Welcome to Let's Talk Near Death, the podcast show that talks about life, death, and experiences somewhere in between. I'm Kirsty Salisbury, the host of the show, and I hope you'll join me as I chat to everyday people with not-so-everyday experiences. You may also wish to join the conversation over in the Let's Talk Near Death online community, which is found at www.letstalkneardeath.com. Membership is free, or you're welcome to upgrade to join the live VIP events, to gain early access to episodes, or to receive extra VIP bonus material. Your support helps me to continue to get episodes out and to help grow the conversation around these types of experiences. But before then, let's talk near death.
I was flatlined on the gurney for 20 minutes. There's no language for what I experienced. I was just standing in the middle of nowhere, looking down on myself and looking out into this vast expanse. And it was kind of like a lesson in judging others. And then I got to see a review of my own life in the same way.
Welcome back to the Let's Talk Near Death podcast, where we talk about life, death, and experiences somewhere in between. In this episode, I am joined by Rob Gentile, who had a near-death experience as a result of a massive heart attack at age 56. It was an event of self-discovery and spiritual awakening, which continued on whilst he waited to receive a donor heart. Rob is also the author of his brand new book, Quarks of Light. And Rob, I want to say welcome to the show, but firstly, congratulations on this book that you've just written.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, Kirsty. I'm honored to be here today.
I can't wait to get into your story. I am lucky enough to have had a little taste tester of your book. It is beautifully written. I encourage the listeners to go and have a read of this book. I couldn't get through the whole thing, but there were definitely parts which I couldn't put down. So beautifully written. Congratulations. We can talk a little bit about that book a little bit later on. But I wanted to ask you, Rob, take us back. What set the stage for your near-death experience and how did this all take place?
Well, it all started. Actually, the timing of this is a little bit freaky because yesterday, 5 years ago, January 26th is the night I died.
Oh, wow.
4 days prior to that, what had happened, this was totally unexpected. What had happened was I had, in another hospital, I had some bone spurs removed from my neck, just some minor surgery, which was a one-day surgery from old sports injuries when I was younger. And 4 days later, in my bed at 11 p.m., the theory is I probably threw a blood clot, but I had a massive heart attack. It was about, 11:30 at night. My wife didn't know what was going on because we have one child. She's special needs. She has seizures, and she thought first it was my daughter screaming, and she ran down the hall, and she realized it wasn't her. She came back into our room, and it was me flopping around like a fish. So she called the ambulance, and thank goodness, we only live like 3 miles from the hospital. And they kept on working on me and working on me until finally I had a wonderful doctor, Dr. Patel, who I'm still good friends with today. Who refused to give up on me, and she was able to obtain a slight pulse somehow until the cardiologist arrived. And when he arrived, he found the blockage, which was in my widowmaker, and he put 2 stents in my heart. But it was too late. My heart was pretty much destroyed, and I had slipped into a 4-day coma. In that time period, they intubated me, of course, so I was completely on life support. And during that 4 days, they would send in neurologists and different doctors to see if I were brain dead. I don't know how they do that, but they do several tests on you to see if your brain is still functioning. And on the 4th day, they said, look, we've waited long enough. We don't know what we're going to have here. We're going to begin to pull the tube out. And if he breathes on his own, we'll take it from there. If he doesn't, then, you know, we have to let him go. So obviously I started choking, And here I am. But when I finally awoke, I was told that my heart was completely destroyed. And that began the journey for a heart transplant. In the book, I read a chapter called Seeking a New Heart. So that's when that all started.
That's amazing. 20 minutes. And so my first thought is, how are you? They've taken the tubes out. How is your body able to sustain life when your heart is completely destroyed?
Well, they had a heart. They had a heart pump in me that they had fused up through a tube in my leg. And this external pump that sat beside my bed was pumping my heart for me. And that's how they were able to sustain life. So once I came out of coma, they replaced that pump with, they put a port in my chest that dripped medicine on my heart, and it would make the heart pump. They called it like STP for the car, to make it run better. But it also wears the heart out faster. And they had a vest on me that looked like a bulletproof vest that was actually a defibrillator vest, so that if I had another heart attack, this thing would just like shock you back to life, which was very pleasant trying to wear that thing. So I had battery packs all over the place that I'm wearing on my left shoulder, on my right shoulder. I've got this port in my chest. I've got this defibrillator vest on. And that's how I left the hospital to begin searching for a heart.
Oh, so you left with all of this gear on you?
Yes.
Far out. Yes. What was that like? Was that terrifying?
It was utterly terrifying because you're in a place where you know you can die again any moment, and you have all kind of additional oral medications trying to keep you alive while you're going through this process of visiting different transplant centers, which is what I did until I was able to finally find a place that would start the, what they call the pre-transplant testing. So I ended up in a completely different state. I went to two clinics here in the North Carolina. We only have two heart transplant centers in North Carolina. Both of them told me that hearts were in very, very short supply, which they are. And it could be 1 to 2 years. And they wanted to put me in this device called the LVAD, which for some people it's fine. But for me, it really wasn't a good option because I couldn't help with my special needs child who can't walk, talk, or feed herself. And I wanted to be able to help my wife. And I couldn't even think about, working that way because I travel for a living. So the LVAD wasn't an option for me. So I was about to quit my job and resign when I called my boss. And at that time, it was kind of a Hollywood story. I didn't know that the owner of the company that I work for, which is privately held, is a bit of a philanthropist. And he has some connections at a hospital in Chicago, which is one of the premier heart transplant centers in the country. Mm-hmm. And it was actually there that I was able to get a heart. But I wasn't transplanted until June of that year. So it was a very long trek and lots of dark times and several times that my body gave out again. I had actually had my second near-death experience right before my donor heart arrived in June of 2016. And that was the most profound experience that I had. My body had given out again, even with all of the pumps and everything that they had on my body, because when I got to Chicago, there was an experimental pump that they had been working on for like 15 years. And I made medical history with that pump because they'd only previously used it on cows and pigs. It was a pump that is about the size of a lunchbox, really. And they said, look, your heart is getting so weak. This is the only way that we're going to be able to keep you alive until a donor heart becomes available, because you never know when one's going to come available.
Yeah.
So I signed up for this thing, and I asked them, if I do this, and the risks were tremendous, but I said, who could it possibly help? And they said, well, if it works, it'll change the history of cardiac care, because people like you, patients like you, will be able to get this pump, and we'll just put a cut in your chest here, and we'll fish this little balloon down through your heart. And then out of the left side of your body is the wires that makes this little pump work, which of course runs on battery and electricity. And you strap this thing around your shoulder and you carry it around. I mean, there was nothing like it in the world. So they said, you know, it'll change the history of cardiac care. And it did. It worked. And it was my bridge to transplant until my donor heart arrived.
You are so brave, Rob. I've got so many levels of things going through my mind. The fact that you're wearing all of this equipment, you've got the fear that you can die at any time. You said that your heart gave out at times. You're then the first person for surgery. You've got a special needs daughter. I have been thinking about your wife and just the strain, and she must be one strong, strong woman.
I'll tell you, Kirsta, she is, but she's paid the price. I mean,
I'm sure.
You know, just she's become a bit wizened and more wrinkles and gray, and it was a very, very, very tough period for our little family, particularly her, who had to stand on the sidelines, you know, and watch all this happen.
Yeah.
But, you know, thank goodness there was a happy ending to the story, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I just want to acknowledge her, because in effect, her efforts have helped to change, I guess, the cardiac treatment that's going on. Like you say, this changed the way that they do things medically within the world, within treatment options.
Yes.
Probably quite a lot of it is thanks down to her. So I want to acknowledge her. She's on my mind. She's on my heart right now. But please take us back. You've had these two near-death experiences. What happened within these experiences? Are you happy to share?
I am. I'll share what I can. We'll leave some for the book, of course. I've got to leave some intrigue there, right?
Yeah.
But I'm happy to share. And the first one is very difficult. It's quite emotional, because what happened was that 7 weeks prior, before I died, my wife's brother, my brother-in-law, his nickname is Frosty, and Frosty had a terrible anxiety problem and took drugs for that problem, and one thing led to another. His life unraveled, and unfortunately he took his life 7 weeks before I died. And when that happened, he was living with his parents. He had gone through a divorce. He was on the verge of losing his business. A lot of tragic things were taking place. But the night he had taken his life, his mother called me and asked me if I would come to the house and go into his room and try to search for a journal that might give the family a clue as to why he would do this. And I went into that room. It was the upstairs bedroom of the house, and I went upstairs 7 times and pick through a gruesome scene until I found the journal. I did find a journal with some of his thoughts, and gave it to, my mother-in-law, and which I hope gave them some peace. But what was curious about Frosty is that when I flatlined that night at the hospital, and it's in my medical records because there was a nurse in a room along with my wife, but right before the monitor went flat, I sprung up off the gurney, and it was like someone just grabbed me by the lapels here, and they pulled me forward like they were trying to get my attention. Mm-hmm. And I opened my eyes wide open, and I screamed his name, Frosty. And then I just fell back onto the gurney and collapsed. And then we flatlined, and code blue rang out through the hospital, and that's when everybody came rushing in. I had no idea that I did that. It was only when I came out of my coma that my wife approached me, and I had remembered that Frosty had come to me. And it was kind of curious, because as my wife approached the bed, you know, of course, all swollen-eyed and crying, and that was the first thing that came out of my wife. I said, "Melanie, you have to believe me that Frosty, your brother, came to me." And she said, "Now it makes sense, because when you right before you flatlined, you were pulled off the gurney with supernatural force." And I began screaming, "Don't go to Frosty, don't go to Frosty," because she thought that, you know, a loved one from the other side was trying to, you know, to help me pass which I've read a lot about. And what happened then is that I told her, I said, he said some things to me. And she said, tell me exactly what did he say to you? And he said, I've made a big mess out of things and I need you to go back and help clean things up. But tell my family that I'm in a good place.
Wonderful.
And that was the first clue to me that the spiritual realm was real, and that someone like me, who had been raised Catholic all my life, you know, we were always taught to believe that suicide was the ultimate penance and that you would go straight to hell. But I can tell you that that place that I experienced with him for that moment felt so peaceful, and none of the anxiety or stress or anything followed Frosty into that place. And it was so lovely there that I wanted to go back there with him. That was the first time, or I should say my first near-death experience. Mm. And then the second near-death experience that I had was in Chicago, right before my donor heart came. There was a series of circumstances that had weakened my body to the point where, even with all of the pumps and the pump that they had put in me, was called the New Pulse, and all the other medications, my body was giving out again. I weigh 172 pounds. Right before my heart came, I was down to about 132. I was a complete skeleton. And I had my second near-death experience. I just pretty much resigned myself to dying at that point. It was at nighttime, and I just screamed out in the middle of the night, "Do with me what you will." And it was in that moment, Kirsty, that, and this is what I write about in the book, and ironically, it's the shortest chapter in the book, called "Into the Ethereal," because there was, and it took me the longest to write that chapter, because there's no language for what I experienced. You probably hear this from other NDEers, but it was, I'll tell you what I experienced. When I said that, I was taken up into a timeless place. It was like I was standing in the middle of nowhere in this infinite timeless vacuum of sorts. And I could see my atrophied, broken body lying in the bed in my green hospital gown with the pump hooked up to me, pumping my heart. And at the same time, it was almost like seeing a hologram of myself standing in the middle of nowhere, but whole, without the pumps and the IVs and the needles and the IV bags and all of that attached to me. I was just standing in the middle of nowhere, looking down on myself and looking out into this vast expanse. It was almost like looking out an airplane window on a clear day when you're in the sky. You know, you could see everything, but nothing at all. It was that kind of an experience. And the first thing that happened to me was that the longer I stayed in that space, I began to see some of the nurses coming in and out of patients' rooms. And what was curious to me was, which was a fascinating kind of life review, is that I'd only seen the nurses that I had made negative assumptions about and had judged really harshly. And I began to see, almost as if somebody was playing a movie backwards, kind of like a regression of their life. And every time something either traumatic happened, whether it was they were hurt by someone or bad personal choices or a big watershed event in their life, it was almost like, you know, the film stopped for a millisecond so I can see what happened to them. And it painted a portrait of what that person had become and why they were who they were in the present time. And it was kind of like a lesson in judging others. And then I got to see a review of my own life in the same way. My life, I saw it as a regression of events. And I remember standing there in the middle of nowhere just saying, how could I have ever judged these people so harshly? How could I ever judge myself so harshly? And it was an incredible moment of peace. And then what happened is so hard to describe, but I saw, and this is where the title of the book comes from and the cover, I saw this gigantic web made of twinkling lights, this interactive web that just seemed to cover the earth and stretch into infinity. And the only way that I can describe this web, and I describe it the best I can in the book, is that it looked like it was made of trillions and trillions of neurons. I don't know if you've ever seen a nerve neuron, probably based on some of your experiences you have, but it has a nucleus, and then it has these tentacles that, you know, they attach to one another, and they're all woven together, much like we have in the brain. And I came to understand when I was in that place that each nucleus represented a life. And it was what I call a cork of light inside each nucleus, or a spark of light. And I came through, after my near-death experience, I researched this, and I came to find out that quarks are the smallest building blocks of matter, and they're all made of light. So that's where the title Quarks of Light came from. And this web, this interactive web, when I was in that place, I understood that it connects all of us, and that we're all one, and we're all connected. And I understood it there, and I realized when I was in that place that I couldn't, there was no place to hide. I couldn't hide any of my actions, good or bad, anywhere in the universe, because since we're all connected, everyone sees them. And it's kind of like how one person's actions affect another. And that was just an amazing, amazing moment for me to understand that and see the oneness of all. And I was thinking to myself in that place, my goodness, this is so simple. It's so easy to understand. It's how the Creator must have done it. One simple design. It's just us humans that make it so doggone complicated. And I began to sense all around me, kind of like these mathematical equations hanging in the air. And any question that I had was already answered. All I had to do was observe, and that question was answered. And I began to sense, and being raised again, a Catholic, you know, I did not see a Christ-like figure. I did not see an omnipotent being, but instead, the Creator chose to, it's hard to explain, but kind of show me concepts that I wholly understood in the moment. Like, I heard things like, I am the power back of all things. I am the origin of all. I am your real identity. And I knew then that, you know, that it was the Creator.
Hi, Kirsty here. Just interrupting this episode just to do a little shout out, really. A huge thank you to our VIP supporters, to our VIP super supporters. In particular this month, I want to acknowledge Anna Ormsby. Thank you for jumping in. I have loved our emails back and forth, getting to know you a bit better, sharing a little bit more about me. And just to say thank you, Anna, because your support as a super supporter, the highest tier of support, means so much to me. For everybody else, just a reminder that there are extra live sessions which we hold over on YouTube, also via the Let's Talk Near Death Facebook page. These happen usually on a Sunday evening around about 6 p.m. Eastern time. It's all dependent on how often I can fit them in. So they're not regular, they're not every week. However, I am trying to get more and more of them in there. So that's another way that you can find value out of the podcast. I look forward to bringing more and more amazing stories from amazing guests. But in the meantime, let's get back to this episode.
And I think one of the questions you asked me that I do want to answer, you had asked me if I had connected with a loved one in that space. And it's kind of curious because here in the temporal world, my daughter Maria, who's the hero of my life, She's 24 now. She has Rett syndrome, which is very rare. It typically only strikes girls. And she's nonverbal. She can't feed herself. She can't use her hands. She can't walk by herself. She's total 24/7 care. And I had a conversation with her. I saw her, and she was standing there in front of me, and she was perfect and whole, and her eyes were filled with beautiful light, not the kind of light that you and I see, but her eyes were filled with the spiritual light that animates all life. And I looked at her, and I get very emotional in this moment. You have to forgive me, but I looked at Maria and I said to her, you know, we've had you and taken you all over the world, and we've tried to find a cure for you, and I don't know what to do for you when you're having seizures, and what is it that I can do more to help you? And at least my experience in the ethereal was that you don't hear anything, you don't smell anything, you don't taste anything. So language is kind of telepathic. It's kind of sensed and felt. It's not actually, you don't hear anything. But in that language, Maria just spoke three words to me. She said, just love me.
Wow. Wow.
And in that moment, it was the first time in my life, honestly, Kirsty, that I felt free and unburdened. All that guilt just washed away, that, you know, in those times when I didn't think that I've ever done the best for her. And that was a very healing moment. And when Maria spoke those three words to me, just love me, I said to myself, I spoke into the vastness of the ethereal, and I said, I never want to leave this place. And I heard those words echo back to me in my spirit. And that's when I found myself back in my bed with the heart pump pumping away.
Oh, gosh, what a contrast. Oh, thank you. I've had two incidents, as you've been talking, of extreme goosebumps. And one of them was when you were saying that you saw Maria and how she was in this beautiful form. That is, what a gift. That is just lovely. Thank you for sharing that, Rob.
You're quite welcome.
Oh, so many things I want to ask, and I don't quite know. I'm just in the state of, I don't know, it's my happy space when I just want to know more, I suppose. My question that's on my mind, you talked about how you saw Maria and your second near-death experience. Did you see Frosty?
No, great question. It was kind of curious that I didn't see Frosty. Frosty just spoke into my spirit. I mean, and, you know, it's kind of curious because I don't know if he said that to me right before I flatlined or when I was in coma. Because I wasn't thinking about Frosty. I mean, why would I scream out his name right before I collapsed back onto the gurney and died? So I really don't know. I meditate on that question a lot, and how it is that he spoke to me, because I didn't see him, unlike Maria, who I saw. And I think that it was kind of like Frosty prepared me, I think, for a much deeper experience during my second NDE, because he opened my mind and my religious beliefs that, again, because someone hurts themselves, they don't necessarily are condemned to this dark place forever. And he opened my mind to this is how it kind of works in this spiritual space, that things are communicated, at least my experience was, things are communicated, how they're spoken into your spirit. Because I came to understand that, and I write a separate chapter about this called Spiritual Beings, Clay Vessels. I personally believe that we're spiritual beings living inside these fragile clay vessels that we call bodies, having a human experience. Mm. And I think that maybe was part of Frosty's mission, in addition to giving that message to his mother and father, who gave them great peace, knowing that he was in a good place.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this is such an important piece of the story, because I get asked all the time, what are my thoughts? What happens if somebody is to commit suicide? Now, I don't condone that. I think there are consequences for that. But yes, I also hear time and time again that if that's what happens, you aren't condemned to a place of hell. You aren't condemned to a place of torture, or, like you said, these beliefs that are imposed on us as we're growing up and as we're forming our own beliefs. We hear a lot of this out there. And I've heard so many stories now of people who have been in a position for committing suicide. And whether that's due to a mental illness or just not being able to cope, or whether it's a mix of both, the scenarios are so personal and so individual. And like I say, I don't think it is a solution as such. I think there are consequences. It's just so reassuring that if that's what we've experienced, if a loved one has gone that way, that there is hope by him coming back and saying, I'm okay. I mean, it must have just brought so much peace to your family. And yeah,
it did. It did. But to your point, and I do want to make the, and I do make this point very clear in the book, as you say, there are consequences.
Yeah.
And the consequence was, is that, you know, his parents, they're still alive, but my in-laws have deteriorated and aged, you know, eons since that happened. I mean, that's a pain that you just can't seem to move forward from. Mm. And his daughter also has suffered a lot from that. So, you know, when I was in that ethereal space before I saw Maria and I was connected to everything, I had this experience where I said to myself, if I hurt myself while I'm in this space connected to everything, then I hurt everyone connected to me. But if I love, the light will spread. So I think it works the same way in the temporal world. And I've come to understand that the web is, you know, nothing more than a reflection of the choices and the things that we do here on Earth, because it all comes together. Our spirit and what we do in the temporal world. And the web is kind of represents, you know, the light and dark struggles that all of humanity goes through in time. And so there are consequences. There are consequences to our actions. And that's something that we all have to remember.
Mm, absolutely. For every action as well, not just talking about these more serious things or the bigger things. It's all about little day choices, isn't it? Everyday things. They all have an impact, a ripple effect. We're all connected, and I hear it so often, so I love to hear it again. Rob, you mentioned very briefly that this had quite a spiritual impact on you. It was quite profound, specifically after the second near-death experience.
Yes.
That you were raised with a Catholic upbringing, with these influences on your life. What has life been like for you since your near-death experiences? What has shaped you, I guess, from a spiritual point of view? How are things today? How are things playing out in that part of your life?
That's a great question, because the first year, so I had to live near the hospital for 1 year after heart transplant, because the hospital is they're responsible for you. You know, heart transplants is different than any other organ. And if something goes wrong, they can lose their license to transplant. So I had to live there alone in an apartment. My wife came back and forth as much as she could, and friends and family came to visit. But overall, I was there by myself. And I became very depressed for a while, not just because I had lost my birth heart, but because of what I experienced in the ethereal, because I wanted to get back to that place. I wanted to get back to that place where I was connected to everything, and where I saw my daughter perfect and whole, and I was free, and I could love freely, and I couldn't. And I went through this ritual. I mean, you'll find this silly, because now looking back, I certainly do, but I would go through this ritual every morning of, you know, prayer and meditation. And I've always been a meditator, but I'd really get into that place where I was just convinced if I tried hard enough that I can get back to the ethereal somehow, you know, and skip out on being in this body. Yeah. It didn't work out too well. So I had a real neat, in the chapter, it's not home anymore. I had a real neat experience with a pastor there. I won't give all of it away, but he came to see me one day, and I had broken down and I had told him what I had been going through. And I told him, I said, you know, I feel so guilty, number one, for getting a heart when a lot of people on my floor died and didn't get one, you know, young people that had their whole lives ahead of them, and so on and so forth. And I said, to boot, after all these sacrifices and everything that I've gone through, not only do I not want to be here, but I don't know where I belong. Mm. And he said to me, he's a Chinese man, and he said to me, you know, the solution to your problem is very simple. And I said, oh, really? What is that? Yeah. And he said, you don't have to leave the earth to experience the divine. The divine is all around you. Yeah. You just have to reconnect to it. And actually, that was my turning point. I went out and I took a walk in nature, and I began to see things really for the first time, not just looking at things, but really seeing things for the first time, and understanding how the similarities between, you know, a solar system, the brain, a plant, an animal, a human being, all of this is so miraculous. And it's such a beautiful experience to be here and to be in the temporal world and to experience these things. And he said to me, you know, you've grown too fat in the spirit on your journey. So to get thin again, he said, you have to give back to God in all the things that you do through kindness and respect and being not judgmental and by serving others. He said, when you serve others, the divine is allowed to express through you. And it was a great lesson for me that I've carried forward through my life now. And it pays off to pay forward and to treat others with respect and be non-judgmental. And I also learned that in that place that, you know, we have to respect everyone else's religious belief. No one can convert anyone. It's up to God to do that. And there's a chapter in my book called All One. And I address this issue because from the time that I was saved here in North Carolina, that night that I died, and it's kind of funny because I call them the Holy Trinity and they're my good friends now. But I had three doctors. I had a woman who's a Hindu. That's the one that didn't give up on me that night. A Sikh, who was the cardiologist, and a Christian man. And when I went to Chicago, I had Jewish doctors, I had Muslim doctors, I had all these different doctors. And so what I wanted to do was examine those world religions and find that common thread that weaves through all of these beautiful people that helped save my life. And I come to find out that, of course, that universal language that God speaks and that thread that runs through all of these religions is love.
Yeah.
And I came to understand that God, love, and light are one. Mm. And now, you know, in my life, I carry those concepts with me. And I understand that we're all connected. I understand that how we allow the divine to express through us while we're here is really all that matters at the end of the day. It's not about what we collect or earn or what position we have in society. It's about how we allow the divine to express. And the rest is really folly because it doesn't matter.
Mm. So how has that played out in your life in terms of going back to work and doing things? I totally agree with what you're saying. I know for myself, after my own experience, sometimes I can forget everything you've just said, and I totally agree with it. How has that played out for you?
Well, I have to tell you that while all of those things might sound a little Pollyanna, right? And, and nicey-nice, but in the real world, of course, we all have struggles. I mean, I still have a special needs child who I have to tend to every day. It's a lot of work. I have to earn a living for my family. There are challenges there. You know, the fact of the matter is that not everybody in the world agrees with us. So, you know, you get into your everyday routine, you do the best you can with it. But keeping those concepts in mind, I think, becomes more of a way of life. It becomes your moral compass. And it's easier to survive the vicissitudes of life when you have this as your foundation and you understand that these concepts are the driving force behind your life. And, you know, it doesn't matter. It kind of like, you know, it falls off of you a bit. Sure, it affects us, you know. Life's hard. There's no one that could, you know where I'm coming from there. Life is hard. But again, that foundation means everything. So now every day when I wake up, I go through a routine. Joy for me comes in the morning when the mind is fresh and I go through a prayer and meditation routine. It really sets the stage for the day. I believe in that. And it helps me get through my day. So that's how it's affected me and in my life now.
I love that. I love those practical elements there too, of the way that you set your day up. Beautiful. You mentioned there that life is hard, and yes, I agree. Life can be really hard. And I know for a lot of our listeners, a lot of them are going through some big things.
Yes.
Life can be hard. Why do you think you were given two chances and yet you still came back? Why did you come back to this hard life? Is there a sense of purpose? Do you know what you have to do, what you have to fulfill? Or is it purely just sharing that love and being part of that connection piece?
Oh, absolutely. There's a sense of purpose in it. I firmly believe, because this was placed on my spirit, when I came out of the ethereal and I was lying there that night, I knew that I was going to be okay.
Yeah,
and it was spoken into my spirit. One word: testify. Tell your story. And it was in that moment I said, how in the world can I explain the unexplainable? I mean, this has been an explainable thing. Most people are going to think I'm crazy. But, you know, and that's why it took me 3 years to write the book. So it was number one, to tell my story, share my story. And, you know, it's that old saying, let those with ears hear and those with eyes see. So I hope my story touches some people to redirect their lives and to be kinder and to understand that we're all together. We're all one. And it's unity now in the world more than anything that we need. I can tell you that. Mm. And I think that the unity and understanding this interconnectedness and respecting one another is the only way that we're going to find peace in our own lives and in the world. So that's part of my mission. The other part of my mission is to see my Maria safely to the other side. I know that my wife was at her wit's end. She couldn't do it alone. So I know that was part of my mission. So it was a dual mission.
Oh, gosh, I'm so impacted by your words. The other time that I had the goosebumps was when you were trying to explain, you mentioned some part from your book saying it's all but nothing. It's, you know, you were saying, I can't even put this into words. My whole mind is just jumbled right now. But it was the vastness. It was how you can't describe the experience. You can't put it into language. It's so close, yet it's so far. It's so big, yet it's so small. You talked about it's like you're looking outside of an airplane window. That it just blows my mind, because that's what I experienced. That's what so many of the people who come on the podcast have experienced.
Yeah.
We can't actually put a lot of this into words, which is why I struggle when I'm trying to say it again now. But I just love your story. I have got so much out of chatting with you today, Rob. I want to say thank you. I want to wish you well with your book. It is a fabulous book. We're going to put the links to that in the show notes. We're going to promote that on the social media pages. So out on the Let's Talk Near Death Facebook page, on the Instagram page. I highly recommend, if you're listening and you want to know more about the story, there are more details which Rob hasn't shared with us today. And they're in that book, and it's a wonderful read. So Rob Gentile, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a delight.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of the Let's Talk Near Death podcast. Don't forget you can join the free online community over at www.letstalkneardeath.com, and I look forward to sharing another episode with you soon.